And I'm sure with a title like The Dragon and Us, you would not think that that has anything to do with Romans. But it does. Let me first read the chapter. This was the outline they were using in Detroit the other day. It says New American Standard. Now, I have a New American Standard, and it varies. I don't know whether you all realize that, but New American Standard Version is an evolving version. And every time they print it, it's slightly different, which is a little disconcerting at times. But I'll read the one they used in Detroit. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due to them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, quote, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, unquote. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, quote, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, unquote. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Do this, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The night is almost gone, and the day is near. Therefore, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly, as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. That's the chapter. It starts, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. I want to bring a companion text in at this point, just as a help. It's in 1 Timothy 2:2. I'll start with verse 1. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and for all who are in authority, in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Now, my first reaction to these Timothy texts is, one of a little surprise, because I have heard brethren that say, well, that doesn't apply anymore because after 1914, these governments are usurpers and therefore you shouldn't pray for them. Now, this is terrible Bible student conclusions. Sometimes I wonder about us. We miss points. Let me back up for a minute. I am very much of the opinion that every ecclesia should be involved in studying the works of the seventh messenger. I think volume study should be going on all the time. I don't think any individual Bible study like Romans 13 should really happen with anybody who hasn't already been through the volumes. Quite frankly, with anybody who isn't still going through the volumes. But the volumes do not give you contextual information frequently. And that's where taking something like Romans 13, or if you want the whole book of Romans, comes in so poignantly, because we see where our favorite scriptures happen to be. One of these, you know this one, it's in Romans 13. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. How many of you have quoted that? Probably everybody in the room. Understanding how it fits into its context is a totally different matter. And probably most of us haven't given much thought to how it fits in the context. So contextual Bible study is exceedingly important. Hence, this concept in 1 Timothy 2 that we are reading. We can take a verse or a part of a verse and pull it out and say, see, that's strengthening my viewpoint about the fact that Gentile times ended in 1914 and our responsibility to governments is no longer there. And you can build all kinds of false structures over a bad foundation. But let's notice what this says here in 1 Timothy 2. First of all, then, well, back up. Go to chapter 1 from 18. This command I entrust to you, Timothy, my son, in accordance with the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you might fight the good fight. This is Paul talking about how Timothy's going to fight the good fight. We want to fight the same good fight. Keeping faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected and suffered shipwreck in regard to their faith. So Paul has in mind that it is quite possible, even understanding the truth, that you can make shipwreck of your faith if you reject certain concepts of how we're supposed to be following the Lord. Among these are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered over to Satan so that they may be taught not to blaspheme. This is going to be part of our lesson. This is why I just backed up. Blaspheme. He's not necessarily talking about blasphemy against God, but the whole concept of blasphemy is a horrible thing in God's sight. We normally put it under the title of evil speaking. That's what blasphemy means. And Paul is terribly afraid that the brethren, hopefully not Timothy, hopefully not those under his instruction, but he's terribly afraid that the brethren are going to slip into the worldly ways of blasphemy, evil speaking. I'm going to be preaching this afternoon because brethren are doing a lot of this. And quite frankly, they're doing a lot of it toward government. This is dangerous. Paul says this is dangerous. Don't believe me, believe him, because he was the Lord's messenger. First of all, then, you notice how he puts that word then in there. You were connected to that previous chapter. He says, I don't want you to blaspheme. What are you going to do instead? First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men. Wow. That's a big assignment. But you can see from the context Paul's concern. If you are indeed giving entreaties, prayers, petitions, and thanksgiving for everybody, you're not going to turn around and say something bad about them. He's using this as an offset to the temptation that we have to do what the rest of the world is doing. You turn on a radio program, I don't care whether it's left ring, right ring, or center, they're all blaspheming. Don't do it. Make prayers and entreaties and thanksgivings and petitions on behalf of all of these people. For kings and all who are in authority. So he's saying, not just your neighbors, but even those who are ruling over you. A lot of brethren, I hate to use the word lot, but it's getting to the point where it's a lot, are becoming political. It may cost you your calling an election. Doesn't matter whether your dragon is blue or red. The only reason we are interested in politics is we are looking for fulfillment of prophecy. We are not looking to correct or to criticize or to be involved with. We are looking in order to see. It's part of the watch and pray that Jesus admonished for us. Make this on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority. And notice now Paul gives the reason. In order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. You see the objective. He doesn't say get all worked up about it. Quite frankly, he says pray for it in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. A lot of us don't sound very dignified. I know I'm going to be stepping on toes. I know I'll even step on my own from time to time. But that's all right. We need to get them stomped on, not just stepped on. Because I assume that you, as do I, would like to end up successful. No point in driving 8 hours to Jackson and back home again and then making a big failure out of it. Okay, back to Romans. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Now there again you could say, oh no, God's throwing them out since the Gentile times have ended. No, that's not true. What God has done when the Gentile times ended is He took the Gentile foot off Jerusalem. He did not end governments. He calls the end of governments anarchy. As Brother David ably pointed out, anarchy is yet future. God didn't put an end to governments. He kept governments here. Thank God He kept governments here, or we wouldn't be sitting in Jackson. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. It's kind of interesting. God even rewarded good, non-religious government leaders. You remember Nebuchadnezzar? He had some problems, and basically God said, go out and eat grass. But when he came back, he recognized God, and God established him and said, okay, you're going to be a good ruler now, which he happened to be. But the fact is, God has blessed certain governments for certain purposes. I've heard you all say that. God blessed the United States so that the truth movement could flourish. Well, he did. That's wonderful. That doesn't mean that any one of these governments has any permanence, doesn't ensure their quality. The only thing it says is God put it there so we might lead godly lives in quietness and dignity. And we should be praying for them and not resisting them. Therefore, whoever resists authority, verse 2, has opposed the ordinance of God. Now, there's food for thought for you. It says if you resist the authority, you are opposing God's ordinances. Now, what a horrible thing for a Christian to be doing, opposing God's ordinances. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Now, if that's saints, it's not a good sounding thing. It could cost us our crowns. Hopefully, it won't cost us our lives, which is the ultimate problem. But it even happens out in the world. Have you noticed in the Gulf crisis, in order to get paid, you have to bring a demonstration of what you made the previous year in order to show how much you lost because of the BP oil spill. That's only fair, isn't it? Because anybody can walk up and say, I won $98,000. That's what I made that last year, even though you only made $9,800. Well, it is a sad fact that a lot of the people who work in that area are self-employed and, shall we say, they paid themselves under the table. And therefore, they paid no taxes. Therefore, they have absolutely no record of what they made the previous year. And now they're complaining that the government won't give them what they made last year. Well, it came back to bite them, didn't it? And that's precisely what Paul is saying. They who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. It is a very modern, obvious application of this verse. Paul is recommending willing obedience. You know, we don't have to like what governments do. That's not part of what Paul's saying. The only government we're ever going to like is the kingdom. That's just kind of automatic, isn't it? But sometimes our rationale is a little peculiar. I remember Peter Coloman. I'm sure a number of you in this room remember Peter Coloman. And he got absolutely outraged. He said, brethren are against Social Security. Brethren are against all of these programs that what do we call them? Welfare programs. He says, have they ever heard of the Jubilee trumpet? The Jubilee trumpet wasn't put there just to give you a date for the Lord's return. It was to point out that people are supposed to get leveled off and helped so that you don't have abject poverty living next door to enormous wealth. So Peter was saying, how come brethren are criticizing these things that are put out there to help the less well provided for? And he has a point. Sometimes our thought processes really get mixed up. We get caught up in the things you turn on the radio and they say, this is terrible, they're wasting $48 billion. And, well, maybe they are, but at least ostensibly they're doing it to help people who need it. With that, we should be in sympathy. (Clears throat) Before I go further, I want to go to Revelation 12. As it melts into Revelation 13, the dragon, of course, is a civil power, and that's what we're talking about at the moment. The very last verse of Revelation 12, and if you've studied Revelation 12, you are very well aware of the fact that the dragon is indeed civil power. The dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Very important verse. You know, brethren sometimes think that the beast is their worst enemy. And the beast happens to be an enemy. False religious systems happen to be an enemy of the church. But there is no question scripturally that civil government, and there again, I don't care whether it's red or blue or purple or any other color, is an enemy of the church. The dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring. You are the rest of her offspring. Until the church is on the other side of the veil, the dragon is going to be making a war with you. You don't make it back. But he makes it with you. And the next verse, 13:1, the first part of it, actually belongs to chapter 12. And he stood on the sand of the sea. When you stand on something, you're holding it down. You know what the sand of the sea is. That part of Abraham's seed, which will be the world of mankind, as opposed to the stars of heaven, which will be the spiritual class. So it is saying the dragon is suppressing mankind. Civil government does this. Now, I've just said all kinds of nice things about civil government, like they trying to help the poor, etc. But the fact is, it also suppresses mankind. Because when you get in power, you tend to misuse power. And I don't want us to lose sight of this particular fact, that the dragon is and always will be an enemy. But not an enemy that we're going out to slay with the sword. We are not St. George. Keep in mind, the dragon keeps his foot on mankind until the end. It'll apply here in Romans 13, we'll see in a minute. Also from Revelation, I won't even go to it, but in chapter 10, the angel there stands and he puts his left foot on the land and he puts his right foot on the sea. Now, the land represents the established part of society. The sea, obviously, the masses of mankind. Right foot is a symbol of right, symbol of favor, thank you. Left is a symbol of disfavor. In foreign languages, it's great. Like, this is your sinister hand, your left hand. It's the bad hand. So, it's real interesting that as we get into the time of the end, the Lord pictures this angel showing disfavor to the establishment and favor to people. This, of course, the saints should always be in harmony with. Now, I'm going to bring up a political fact, not in order to be political, but just because I think brethren have studied Volume 4 for decades and missed something. According to Brother Russell, it is the right-wing political and religious systems that will fight the establishment of the kingdom. Did you miss that? Now, he doesn't use the term right wing. But he gives everything, because it wasn't used that much in his day. But he does everything in his power to show you that that phalanx of powers, political and religious, are what are going to oppose the establishment of the kingdom. Now, if brethren before they had the truth happened to be right wing, that's fine. But after you read volume 4, I would suggest you give it a second thought. And I'm not saying that should make you left-wing political. I'm saying it should make you apolitical, because just remember that dragon is holding down the sand of the sea, and he is out to make war with the rest of the offspring of the woman. He's not a friend of yours, no matter what he does. But scripturally, prophetically, always keep in mind which end of the spectrum is going to be the big enemy of the establishment of the kingdom. If you've missed that in volume 4, go back and read it again. It is powerfully supported by prophecy. Don't forget, God is called the Lord of hosts. Pretty literally, that means of armies, but I think in the really prophetic sense, it means of the masses. God is in favor, or holds in favor, the masses of mankind. And since the dragon holds down the masses, God does not look favorably upon the dragon. He is the Lord of hosts, not the Lord of the establishment. All right, I think we can go back to Romans 13. I'm going to start back with verse 1 again. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. You're probably saying accurately, that's not always true. You know, the Nazis were a cause of favor, of fear, if you did some good things. And they were no fear at all for people who were doing bad things, as long as it agreed with what the Nazis wanted. So Paul obviously is not making an absolutely flawless rule here. Paul is making a generality, but it is a generality which usually applies. Rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? What's Paul's solution? He says, you don't want to fear the government? Do what's right. What a logical solution. And most of the time that'll work. Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. Verse 5. Oh, I ought to mention this before we go on. Twice in verse 4, the word minister, and once in verse 6, the word servants, these are both New American Standard, are the Greek diakonos, deacon. I just find that rather curious that Paul is saying God has deacons. And the governments are his deacons. They are doing what he wants done in order to preserve some semblance of sanity before everything breaks loose in anarchy. Okay, verse 5. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. I love what Paul does in verse 5. He breaks down the reason for being obedient to laws. In the first one, he says, not only because of wrath, not only because you're going to get a ticket as you go home at 85 miles an hour. He says, that's a good reason. But that's not the overriding one. Not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. You realize he's saying the government is helping you develop your conscience. I doubt anybody in this room ever gave that a thought, that the government is helping you develop your conscience. But that is Paul's thought. He's saying, as they impose these rules, which they do in order to preserve what they see as good, It helps you think. Should I be doing this? Because apparently it's good. And what he's doing here, and this is going to be important as this chapter proceeds, he's opening up a conscience of us as having a place in society. Yesterday we discussed the fact that as Christians we are individuals before the Lord, but we must be part of a body. And therefore we have these compromises we make so that the body can work well together. Now he's going to do the same thing here, but not relating us to the body of Christ, but relating us to the society around us. Very much the same thought, just with a different group of people. Six. For because of this, you also pay taxes. I hope all of you who are consecrated have never tried to avoid taxes. And if you have, give it another thought. This is not David Duran speaking. This is the Apostle Paul speaking. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you ought to pay taxes. Paul's saying, you should be supporting the maintenance of desirable living circumstances. You shouldn't be grumbling and saying they're wasting it, which they probably are. But that's not the point. Wherever there is anything established for good in an imperfect world, part of it's going to be used for bad. That goes without saying. That doesn't mean you don't establish the thing that's set there to do good just because it's going to be misused. Very important philosophy. You don't pay taxes because you like how all of them are used. You pay taxes because you concur that it is good to have government. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God. That makes your taxes kind of like the Jewish tithe, doesn't it? If rulers are the deacons of God, they're kind of like the Levites. And you're giving them a tithe, only you call it a tax. Or they call it a tax, whatever it happens to be. The point is, you agree with the fact that they are going to maintain speed laws, they're going to patch your highways, they're going to try to keep the air from getting polluted, they're going to send you a Social Security check when you get old enough. All of these things, he says, you pay taxes for. And he makes it sound like it's a great idea. Now, you turn on politicians of any color, taxes are a terrible thing. And they use it against each other. They're going to tax you. No, they're going to tax you. They already taxed you. Oh, I know, but they're not doing it right. That's not Paul's argument at all. Paul says, you're taxed, pay it. It's helping to support the lack of anarchy. For this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing, to being the ministers of God in maintaining law and order. I hope you're changing your mind right now from Romans 13. Every one of us should be changing our minds. Remember, you are renewed by the transforming of your mind. Let the Scriptures change you. Let it change your attitude. Let it get rid of the blasphemies that tend to be coming out of our mouths. There are brethren that run political websites. Ouch! Okay, Paul continues. Verse 7. Render to all what is due them. I like that word due. It means it's legitimate. They really ought to have it. It is justly theirs because God has made the arrangement. He has set up the arrangement. Paul's been saying this from verse 1. Render, that means pay, to all what is due them. tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. That word has a real broad meaning. It can mean all kinds of things. It can mean customs in the sense of what you pay as you go from Detroit into Canada. It can mean custom as in when you leave the room with the queen in it, you back out. Whatever the custom happens to be, this word kind of covers it all. And Paul's saying some people, because of their station, you owe certain customs to. You know, if it's President Bush or President Obama, you really ought to call him President Bush or President Obama. Not Bush and Obama. Or not, as I saw on the news the other day, when they were showing the president giving his recent Oval Office speech and they had him dressed up in a Hawaiian shirt. There's no call for that. There's no call for that. I don't care whether you agree with the way he's handling things or not. That's immaterial. That's blasphemy for a saint. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. You'll be more comfortable. And those to whom you owe these things, according to the Apostle Paul, will respect you for it. Then comes this out of context verse that we always hear. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. Okay, I think taking that out of context is just almost criminal. It's important to connect it to verse 7. Remember, 7 was based on the three-letter word do. D-U-E. Now, if you don't pay something to somebody to whom it is due, you end up owing them. And here's the connection between these two verses. As verse 8 opens with the word owe, it is Paul continuing the thought that you really owe tax, custom, fear, honor. And he says, don't owe those things. Pay them. He says, there is one thing that you do owe, and that's to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. You know, Jesus made that his answer to the one who asked him, which is the great commandment of the law? And he said, well, the first one is you love the Lord your God with all your heart, strength, soul, mind, and I can't ever get it quoted straight. And the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And this, Paul is going to be commenting on now for the several verses in a row. And he's saying, I want you to understand something. I want you to know what this second commandment means. I don't want it to be abstract to you whatsoever. I want you to realize that you are part of a human community, not only an ecclesia community. You are part of a human community. And you owe that community love. When you go beyond the veil, hopefully as successful saints, that's what you owe the world of mankind that you're going to be helping them. Then you'll be able to do it successfully. But right now he is saying, you owe. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. And he continues. He says, listen to the law. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And then Paul got tired of listing, so he says, and if there's any other commandment, he says, doesn't matter what the commandment is, it all boils down to one thing. It is summed up in this saying, as it says right there in verse 9, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Obviously, you're going to ask the question, how do you love yourself? Which is a legitimate question. And it has a very simple answer. I think if you stop and think about it, what it means to love yourself is you do what you feel is best for your good. That's what we all do. Even people who hate themselves think it's for their own good to do so. It's very strange. We as human beings have all quirks and foibles and everything else. But the fact is, we all love ourselves, meaning we do what we think is the best for our good. And Paul says, that's all I want you to do for everybody else that's alive. I want you to do what is best for their good. He says, that's commandment number two. The one that Jesus said, it's like the first one. If you don't get the second one, you don't have the first one. That's what Jesus meant when he said it's like unto the first one. The first one is null and void if the second one doesn't exist. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Actually, that's sort of Paul's end of everything he said from verse 1. He's saying, cooperate. Cooperate with government. Pay taxes, pay customs, pay anything you owe to anybody. Do whatever you can, because those entities are trying to do things to help people survive. And he says, that's part of loving your neighbor. Wouldn't you want them to help you survive? If you've ever had any political opinion, it should be based on that very thing. What can the government do to help people survive? That's it. That's the best function of any government that exists. Okay, now Paul brings it back to us in verse 11. Do this, knowing the time. Knowing the time. Well, you know, when he wrote this, it was the beginning of the age. It's going to strike us very differently. But quite frankly, you know, Brother X that lived in the Ephesus church might have had 40 years left to his life. And perhaps you would have 40 years left to your life. I doubt it. But the fact is, the time's always short. And I think this verse 11 is a personal application. Do this, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you, I love this phrase, to awaken from sleep. So if anything that the Lord has privileged us to say this afternoon from this platform has gotten to you, that's great. It helped me awake from a little sleep Friday afternoon in the Detroit study. Because I see some things differently and I think better today than I did last Thursday. And Paul is saying, look, you're going along halfway asleep through most of the things you deal with your government or your neighbors or anybody else. Do this, knowing the time that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. And you know that's true. If you were consecrated 10 years ago, you're 10 years closer to your salvation and to the kingdom. Paul's saying, don't waste time. Change. If you've been criticizing taxes, shut up. It's wrong. It says it's wrong. Don't do it. Transform your minds. Now he's telling us that we're in the final age. Like, there's never going to be a chance for this again. There's never going to be another call to the church. The night is almost gone. You know, it was day number 5 at the time Paul was writing this. 5 out of 7. So we were closing in, especially since the 7th is the kingdom. He only had 5 and 6 left. The night is almost gone, and the day is near. Therefore, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Ah, here he's saying, look, you've been criticizing taxes and Caesar, and you've been dwelling in the darkness. He says, take that darkness off and dwell in the light. Live as if it's the kingdom. I doubt that if in the kingdom Jesus said, I want everybody to pay a farthing in taxes, they're all going to say, no! How can I get out of it? Let me see my lawyer, my tax accountant. Live as if it's in the kingdom. Lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. And one of the lusts of the flesh is blasphemy. May the Lord add His blessing.